Welcome to the official podcast of the Next CMO, hosted by Plana. This is a thought leadership podcast for those that are CMOs or want to become CMOs. My name is Kelsey Kraft, and I'm the Senior Marketing Manager.
And I'm Peter, the CEO and co-founder of Plana.
For this week, we have Dan Faulkner, the CTO of Plana. Dan just wrote a series of blog articles on marketing stakeholders and culture and how to do a self-assessment of your team. I invited him on the show to discuss what exactly this means as a marketing leader. And I have to ask, my first dying question is, what does DNA have to do with marketing?
Well, so yeah, the self-assessment is all about understanding your team's marketing or your company's marketing DNA. And the analogy I'm trying to draw is that, in biological terms, an organism's behavior and capabilities are defined by its DNA. And I believe that there are structural organizational traits that make up a marketing team's DNA. And those traits drive the marketing team's structure and behavior. So, you know, it's clear that a matrixed marketing team supporting an international B2B company is going to be structured and operate differently to a centralized marketing team working in a domestic B2C company. And if your marketing DNA isn't a good match with your company DNA, you're probably not going to do as well as you could. But I think the good news is, you, unlike in biology, you can change your marketing DNA.
So, Dan, you've lived up to your reputation of being a nerd with that analogy. You're welcome. I'm here to help. So why don't you, just to set the table here a little bit, you, in your blog article, and we'll link the thing in the show notes so you can go and read it to your heart's delight. Why don't you just tee up sort of these four different kinds of attributes or traits that make up the marketing DNA from your warped little mind? Did I say that out loud? I'm sorry. That was a little negative.
I can say
your
warped,
incredibly
little, but warped and little.
Warped big mind?
Yeah, sure.
Go ahead.
I'll take it. So, the first kind of trait is you can work in a centralized model, an internal agency model, a matrixed model, or an integrated model. The second is, and so that's all about kind of structure. The second is about the offering that you bring to market. You selling a service, a solution, technology, product, or platform. The third is about how you go to market, you B2B or B2C. And the fourth is whether you're a domestic business or an international business.
Great. Well, that makes a lot of sense. And obviously those are hopefully understandable kind of concepts for people, but let's look at the first one to start, the one about the structure of the team. Now, you and I worked together for many years. I have to remind you of that frequently. And we, of course, worked through a lot of the transitions through those models. I think we worked in every single one of those models at the same company as we went through a lot of growth. But tell me from your perspective, maybe what did you find the most effective and maybe what was the most traumatic or painful change to go through as we went from one to another?
So the model I think that I found most effective would probably be what I call the integrated model, which is what happens when you have I think it's really suitable for a larger organization. So we were quite a large organization when we got to that point, and we had business units that had quite a large variety of offerings. They were addressing different target markets, different pricing models, different value propositions, different events they went to, or, you know, just really a different kind of model. And so what happened then was the business units integrated certain marketing functions, like product marketing, which made sense because they had unique packaging and value proposition for their products. They had field marketing, which kind of made sense because field marketing was out there doing high touch, you know, small customer events and supporting the field. But then there were other key functions that remained at the corporate level. So public relations, of course. It's a skill set that's broadly applicable. Branding, corporate events, these were all things that remained in the corporate marketing team. And I think that that I found to be quite effective. If you put too much in the business unit, they don't have the scale and they can go off and start doing crazy things. And if you centralize too much, a centralized, you know, in a big company like that, the centralized team might not have the required insight to do very well targeted product positioning and field marketing. Does that jive with what you think, Peter?
It does. I think it worked pretty well. And maybe I'm biased because that was the model that I ended up implementing when I was in the CMO role there at Nuance. But I'll tell you, the transition was really painful. The value of doing that, of course, is that you have, in fact, the thesis around the recommendation to do that was that you have the specialty areas within marketing that require a deep understanding of the customer or the market segment within the part of the company, the division that served that market. So product management, product marketing, even to some extent, a level of field marketing where they're directly engaging with customers. And then we were at a point where we used to use a lot of external agencies, and we got sort of a soup of different campaigns, of different brand executions. It was sort of all over the place. So the idea was to have a very deeply specialized set of skills that went from sort of the brand and the creative side to get some, not only consistency, but to be able to afford some deep experts in that area. The things like the systems side. So the marketing tech stack was owned and driven at a centralized level because it made sense for consistent measurement. And then also some of those things like communications to get a single message and communicate to the influencers correctly. So yeah, I think it worked well. The change was hard because people always have a difficult time sort of giving up something that they might have previously controlled. And so that was probably the hardest part. And it never made sense for us to be completely centralized, as an example. So to take the counter example, it didn't make sense because it was just, we were in a business that had very different businesses under an umbrella of a single company. And you really needed deep expertise in that area. So I think that made a lot of sense. Yeah, but the transition part is the hardest part, I think. Once you're there and it's fully operated, and it probably took a year for us to really get to the point where it was working well.
So how does the marketing function change as you go from, you know, service to platform?
Yeah, so that's a big spectrum, Kelsey. So, you know, on one end of it, I've got a service where everything's customized and built one-off for customers. You go through a solution where you might have some productized capabilities, but there's still lots of professional services required. Then you might have a core technology, so literally a low-level capability that's not really packaged into a product that can be used by end users. Then you have a product, then you have a platform. So a platform could be a multi-function product that's extensible, that has integrations and so on. So if you're at one end of that spectrum and you're in a professional services model, like a systems integrator kind of world, for example, it's all about relationships. You're going to sell to people. You're going to be looking for large, long-term relationships, which means you're likely to have a focus in your marketing strategy on in-person events, account-based marketing, highly customized, maybe even personalized marketing messages, lots of sponsorships to make sure that your target audience knows who you are, mm-hmm. and, you know, and what you do. Whereas as you imagine now that you kind of work your way along that spectrum and you're now talking about a software as a service product, then you're looking at, a much more kind of inbound marketing, digitally driven strategy. You may still have some focus on events, but maybe your focus on those events is being seen and getting foot traffic coming through your events rather than having something really oriented around customer meetings. And then when you get to something like a consumer packaged good business, then it's all about kind of multi-channel advertising and branding. So it's depending on what you're selling and depending on your go-to-market motion, it's going to be really quite a different set of skills that you need to own in-house, that you outsource, and how you need to structure.
Yeah, you have a nice chart, Dan, in the blog that, again, we'll link in the description, that highlights some of these differences. But there's a lot to consider. You mentioned a little bit about the go-to-market motion, which is one important consideration, sort of how you engage with the market, how you define the market. Is it a limited thing? Is it a broad-based thing, et cetera? But also the messaging and what you're selling even. You know, so are you messaging, if it's services, you're really packaging up the capabilities of the company versus if you're a product, then you're going to be talking about the features and benefits that that specific thing delivers to you in a very packaged, consistent way. So everything from the target market, the go-to-market motion, the message, the channels, everything can vary pretty significantly as you go from solution to service. And it's interesting, this is another thing that is sensitive to change, because you see people go through this evolution. And I think if you're in the SaaS world, as an example, a lot of people start out in one and then go to the other. It's often people either start as a service because they're trying to start from zero and build something, and they want to be a product. And they really struggle with the shift in marketing to do that. But the other thing you see a lot of is people go from a single point solution to more of a platform. And there's some big companies who have gone through this. So HubSpot is probably a good one. They had a product at the beginning, and now they've sort of built out to a platform. And then some of the HubSpot alumni that went and started Drift are doing sort of the same thing, right? They had a product, right. They had a chatbot kind of thing, and now they're trying to build that thing out into a more sophisticated platform. And that transition requires a rethink in the way that they approach their marketing.
Agreed. And it's something that you really need to have a position on. I feel like something that we, in our, you know, earlier in our career, certainly something I struggled with in one of the business lines I worked in, was there was this kind of endless debate about, are we a product company or a services company? And the answer actually was we were a solutions business. That was a solutions business, but there was this kind of dithering, and it hurt us a little bit because we didn't take a position and stick to it. So I agree with what you're saying there, Peter.
Yeah, and of course the marketing strategy that you employ is one piece of a broader problem you're trying to solve. As you said, there's the whole company, or in your case the divisional strategy is an important one to think about, because that might imply how you, beyond the marketing stuff, how you build the product, how you service your customers, all those things are going to be quite a bit different. So let's move on to the next one, because I think it's interesting, because of the people think of you being in one box or the other, whether you sell to consumers or you sell to businesses. And that, of course, is a easy to understand distinction. They're all the hybrids, like B2B to C, as you're going through channels and things like that. But if you look just at that B2B or B2C, you brought up an interesting point that some B2B people are acting a little bit more like B2C people. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, sure. So the classic B2B model is, I think, often viewed of being, you know, you have a high cost, high touch sales team of people who are flying all around the world or the country to meet customers face to face, and you're going to lots of trade shows, and it's a very expensive sort of bottom of the funnel set of activities. And what's happened with a lot of the software as a service offerings that are clearly B2B software as a service offerings is, first of all, they come in at a slightly, and actually often a much lower price point than customized large enterprise solutions. And they are built to be integrated and used easily. So they lend themselves well to high velocity marketing methods. So heavy use of digital advertising, heavy reliance on inbound marketing for lead generation rather than, you know, sort of highly targeted customized target account sort of marketing. And I think that's become almost the norm, actually, for high-velocity SaaS companies. What they call product-led growth companies are really trying to focus on getting that profile of go-to-market for a B2B offering that looks a lot like what used to be considered a B2C motion.
Yeah, it's interesting, Dan, because I think a factor that is making people change their approach is the concept that companies don't buy things, people buy things. And I think more and more marketers are embracing that and treating their prospects as a bunch of people, not a bunch of companies. And as a result, they have more sort of that one-on-one kind of market to people kind of thing, which definitely lends itself more to some of the B2C techniques that you might have before. And some of it is just the increase of digital approaches in general. But the one thing I wanted to mention too is I've seen some of the opposite happen, meaning that sometimes there are B2C companies who need to think a little bit more like B2B companies. And you think about this when there's a longer consideration cycle for a product. And it's funny, it reminded me when I was reading your blog about some time we spent when I was running the Dragon consumer software business for Nuance. Right. And we always thought of it as a consumer, simple consumer product because we charge somewhere between $100 and $300 for the software. And we thought, that's a consumer thing. That's easy. That's just a simple, you know, put a website out there and someone's going to buy it. But what we found, which is really interesting, is that even for $100, it's a long consideration cycle. So people think about it, mm-hmm. they research it, and you actually need to build in things like nurturing and multi-step campaigns for sometimes consumer products if they have a longer sort of education consideration process that's part of it. So I think the point is that your thesis here is that you need to understand which one you're at. And I agree with that. But it doesn't mean that you have to stay in your lane all the time. In fact, you should probably, one, understand you know, what if you're selling to businesses or selling to consumers, obviously that implies some very different kinds of techniques, but it doesn't mean you can't borrow from one or the other, if that makes sense to you.
Yeah, it does. Makes a ton of sense. And as with, you know, many times when we categorize things, we don't have sharp boundaries between them. So it makes a lot of sense.
Yep. Yep, exactly. So the next area, so let's see if where are we on our waypoint, right? We went through sort of the structure of the marketing thing. We went through whether it's a service or a product. We went through or a platform, et cetera. We went through B2B or B2C, and the last attribute is international or domestic. And it always reminds me of my Ian story. Can I tell my Ian story? It's one of my favorites.
Please do.
Okay. I feel like I have to tell this because I'm talking to you, Dan.
And you think Ian is a British name?
It is. That's the idea. So here's what happens is that I've been involved with a lot of companies who started out as a domestic company and then they turn into an international company. And of course, this is something that's painful for me as I think about, because I think about planning and budgeting, because that's all I think about these days. And when you go through this concept, when you start your international marketing, the first thing you do is you hire an international marketing manager. And I worked at a bunch of companies that always, for some reason, said, we're going to go to Europe, so we're going to start in the UK because they, you know, sort of look and act most like us in the US, even though I know you don't want to admit that, Dan. And inevitably, it was a guy named Ian. Maybe he was Colin or whatever, but it was often some guy named Ian. So you hire Ian, and that became our shortcut, for the name of the first international marketing manager. And so you hired Ian, and And what do you do? The first thing you do is say, well, I've got a $5 million marketing budget. I'm going to give $800,000 to Ian. So I hand Ian the budget and say, here it is. Here's the budget. Put together your plan. And as soon as you hand that budget over to Ian, it's completely opaque. You have no idea where it is. And what happens the first time you need to make a change, you call Ian and you say, Ian, we need to fund something over here, or we need to cut the budget. How much of that budget is committed? And what does Ian say every single time, Dan?
100%.
He does. Exactly. So it's the challenge that you get is this, when you're planning and budgeting, of course, it's a huge issue in visibility in doing that. But I'm sure there are many other factors beyond planning and budgeting that you had in mind. So give me a sense of some of the other factors that you think are important when it comes to domestic versus international marketing teams, or multinational is the right way to think about it.
Yeah, there's lots. And some of them are really just very pragmatic, like time zone differences. Where do US companies go after Britain, Peter?
After Britain, they go to Australia.
Exactly. They go to Australia, conveniently upside down from a time zone perspective. The interesting thing there, of course, is you want to include them in the meetings, and you want, and it's hard. It's really hard to just logistically schedule and communicate effectively. So there's that kind of thing. Then there's scale. So it's likely, and we'll assume, you know, for the sake of the argument, that this is a company that's based in the US and, you know, that started in the US. Of course, they've got all the resources there. There's one person in Australia, and it's natural that the team in the US says, great, go and set up our presence at this event. And of course, we're going to need to think, you know, convey our brand, and we're going to need to do some advertising. And suddenly there's one poor person who's trying to operate at an enterprise scale with suboptimal communication lines. So just being realistic about how much can that person do? How much are they going to rely on partners to do marketing for them, or consultants to do marketing for them, is a really important thing. Then, of course, there's the thing that we've discussed a lot, Peter, currencies. So how your company deals with currencies, and the fact that if you're a domestic company and you become international, you need to be ready to understand how international currencies are going to affect your plan. You're going to be spending them. Are you on the hook for the potential exposure to currency fluctuations, or is the company? And that's something that can burn you if you don't get it right. And it's something that your company can really protect you from as a marketer if it's well planned out ahead of time. So yeah, they're just a few.
Yeah, we could probably do a whole podcast on the currency issues, Dan, because yeah. And the interesting thing that happens, by the way, with currency issues is that there's often the opposite effect between marketing people and salespeople, because when it's favorable for sales counting revenue, it's unfavorable for marketing when it comes to managing expense. And the opposite, obviously. So they can be a little bit at odds, and sometimes they want to use different techniques and different conversion rates, based on, someone will want to use the current spot rate. Others will want to say, no, we want to use the rate that's in the plan because that's more favorable for me. That's a battle that happens from time to time.
With B2B and B2C techniques, they're different. And when you're going to a different international territory, the marketing has to be different too. You can't just duplicate what you're doing in one region to the next because of, you know, either language barriers or even laws and regulations that are in play.
That's a great point, Kelsey. And the laws and both of those, again, are huge topics that probably warrant their own discussion at some point. I completely agree. The list is long. I do remember. I think we might have actually had a head of European marketing called Ian at one point. But what you'll also often see is that the product that you've built, even unwittingly, has been optimized for the US market, for the US end user. And I'm not talking about obvious things like, you know, language. I'm talking about literally there are cultural differences and user expectations between different countries that need to be well understood.
It's like building a relationship before you sell to them.
Yes.
Yep. And Kelsey knows from what she's speaking about, because you spent some time working for HubSpot in Australia, right?
Yeah, that's right. And you definitely, in Australia market, you have to build that relationship before you can even send them a selling type of email, or they're just going to write you off immediately. And that's true for a lot of regions and countries. Now, going back to the DNA, so is this kind of a one and done thing, or how do you need your DNA of your marketing environment to evolve?
Well, it needs to evolve because your company is going to evolve. Companies that don't evolve tend not to do well in the long run. And it's important that the marketing DNA is in lockstep with the company's DNA. Definitely it's something that periodically you should check in on and see how and where to make adjustments.
So your analogy is broken, Dan, unless we think about the company as like a species versus an individual, right? Maybe that's the right way to think about it.
Kelsey, I just want to go on record as saying, apparently I'm the nerd here.
I think I got two nerds on the phone, maybe three.
All right. So let's think about this from a strategic perspective then, Dan. We've got this evolving kind of structure and function of a company. Things are changing over the time. Some things change faster, some things are slower. Strategically, how do you handle that? How do you set up your team to adapt?
Well, it has to be a cultural expectation. I think, you know, we've talked about this before, that not just successful marketing teams, but successful teams in general embrace change and should be built for change. From a kind of a tactical perspective with respect to this particular topic, what you should do is periodically, and the periodicity needs to be defined by the cadence of your business, check in, go through that list of DNA traits and say, how are we operating? How are we structured? And who are we now? And if you see a gap starting to open up, if you have evolved from being a core technology company to a solutions company, if you've decided to go from being domestic to international, you need to just give yourself room to set yourself up properly. Rather than discover, because you're running into lots of problems. So I would, you know, definitely recommend a periodic check-in against that checklist, and then what needs to be done should make itself somewhat apparent.
Yeah, well, that's great advice, and I agree. If you have a solid strategy process where you're looking, maybe it's twice a year, maybe it's once a year, but you're really stepping back to assess what your market is, what your company is, what's going on externally and internally, I think that's a really important thing to take on board. So great discussion, Dan. I think this is relevant for all of us to think about as we think about our planning, especially right now where everyone's in the middle of sort of rethinking and replanning as they adapt to a pretty significant shock to the market as we're dealing still with pandemic stuff at this point. Right. But very timely, appreciate it. And I think, Kelsey, it's time to take us home.
Yeah, thanks so much, Dan. We really appreciate the conversation. If you haven't checked out the article, you can view it on our blog. Make sure to follow The Next CMO and Plana on Twitter and LinkedIn. And if you have any ideas for topics or guests, you can email them at thenextcmo@plana.com. Have a great day, everyone. Enjoy your Memorial Day weekend.